afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to another episode of Dark Reading Radio. What you probably missed in the latest Verizon Data Breach Investigations Report. I'm Kurt Franklin, and we'll be handing things off to our wonderful host and guest in just a moment. But before we do, I want to remind everyone that if you're here with us live, and you know you really should be, then the audio portion is only part of what makes Dark Reading Radio such a great experience. The other part is our online text discussion. And we would love to have your voice in that online text discussion. Now, to take part, all you have to do is type your comment or question into the box labeled your post. Then be sure to click that big red post button below the box. Our host and guest will be joining that conversation at the bottom of the hour. Between now and then, you'll have a chance to talk about what you're hearing and get your questions and comments lined up and ready for them to join that discussion. Well, in order to get there, first we have to have the audio conversation, and to lead that, we've got Kelly Jackson Higgins, executive editor of Dark Reading. Kelly, welcome to Dark Reading Radio.
Thank you, Kurt.
And it sounds like things are going to be exciting, so I'm going to step out of the way and turn things over to you.
Sounds great. I appreciate the intro. So as a lot of you know, Verizon's annual data breach investigations report for the past 8 years has kind of been one of the more anticipated and quoted sources of data on real-world cyber attacks and trends. And this year's report was huge. There were almost 80,000 security incidents across 61 countries, 2,100 of them or so, which included actual data breaches. And Verizon had gathered data from 70 different contributor organizations, everything from service providers to government agencies, certs, and security vendors. So given all that, there's a pretty good chance you probably missed a few interesting and probably really relevant nuggets from the report. I know I feel like I did. So that's why I want to do this show. And with me today is our guest, Mark Spittler, who's the co-author of the DBIR and senior risk analyst with Verizon. Welcome to Dark Radio, Mark.
Hi, Dark thanks Radio. For having me.
So, Mark, I know we talked a little bit about this the other day, and I guess really the thing is there's some parts of this report I know that you agreed to that maybe didn't get as much publicity or may have been sort of inadvertently overlooked. So that's what I kind of want to talk about. But to get started, I was curious about sort of why and how Verizon ended up getting so many contributors to this year's report.
So, yeah, we did have quite a few. We had 70 this year, which was up from 50. You know, first off, one of the great things was is, you know, the majority of people that have shared with us data with us continued to do so. So right off the bat, we already had a solid foundation. We were able to also get even more data because we kind of opened it up a little bit. And one of the biggest changes from this report from prior years is a lot of the research that we did into things that weren't necessarily from incidents or data breaches, which was really and still is the cornerstone of the report. It's still the Data Breach Investigations Report, but kind of opening it up to a lot of these companies and organizations that were willing to share really rich data sets that you know, weren't necessarily, again, data breaches, but really contributed to the report in a big way is really one of the ways that we were able to just continue to increase the amount of people that were sharing data.
Are we going to see more and more organizations contributing in the years to come as well?
Obviously, we certainly hope so. It's amazing just if you look at the number and how it's increased. I mean, it started with our own forensics investigators, and that's how we began this little journey 8 years ago. And to grow from that to 70 is absolutely amazing. And I think it really shows a lot. It shines a really good light on the security industry that so many organizations, both private and public sector, are willing to do this type of incident or information sharing for the greater good.
So, Mark, before we kind of drill down into which sections and findings of the report that may have been maybe not got as much press as they should have, you and I talked about how the report can, how companies can use the report for actionable information that they can take back to their companies. And you mentioned that there's a section in the report that you kind of need to get started with. That's actually the best way to kind of address, to sort of tackle the big thing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So, you know, if you have the report in your hands, you're looking at the PDF and you're, you know, you have 5 minutes to do something with it. I would go right to figure 29, I believe it's on page 34 of the report. And what that does is that's a really quick figure that you can take a look at your industry. And what we've done with all the incidents is we put them into one of 9 categories or incident classification patterns. And so that one will show you left to right, but, you know, what percentage of each of those patterns represents, you know, the full incident corpus for that particular industry. So someone like accommodation, it's right around 91% fall into the point of sale intrusion category. So right off the bat, and it's, you know, makes a bit of sense, right off the bat you can know, hey, this is obviously that's something that is occurring in, you know, in the real world at a very high rate to organizations like me. I mean, from there, you can take it, you can step into each of those subsections, you know, for those patterns and really get the most bang for your buck. Another thing you can do is, you know, obviously, you know, we do reference a lot of things, you know, kind of make some recommendations, some technologies, some processes that can be put into place. So if you see some things like that, you know, go ahead and quote the report. Obviously, and you can take this. You can take this to someone and say, hey, look, you know, it's written here. You know, these are the types of things that are coming after us. We see it here. This is real world stuff. And, you know, we're trying to do this security initiative, and this would map directly and would disrupt this pattern, would disrupt this threat actor that's most commonly associated with our, you know, organizations like us or people to deal with the type of data that we deal with.
So basically organizations should go in and bookmark that section and kind of start there and work their way back through.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, I'm a little biased. I don't want people to read it cover to cover and laugh and cry along with us. But really, that figure and our ability to put all of these incidents, you know, 80,000 incidents, putting them into 9 patterns, makes it so much more manageable and makes it so you can actually wrap your head around it. And for us to be able to do that and to be able to do that matrix, that's one of the most actionable figures that we've ever had in the Data Breach Report. And, you know, it started last year and we continued this year. And I really think that's the one that people should be looking at first.
Great. Well, that's a really good tip because I know this report this year was so big. I remember trying to read it and quickly digest and figure out what angle I was going to take for my story. So I think that's really helpful for folks who want to, you know, get some actionable info out of it as well. So thanks for the tips there. So in terms of things that maybe didn't get as much play in the press or maybe just in discussions in the industry from the report, one of the ones I know that you and I had spoken about were trends in hacking for payment card data. Talk a little bit about, Mark, sort of the findings there that you felt were pretty important that you think deserve some notice and recognition and maybe some discussion.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting kind of roller coaster ride as far as payment card breaches within our report and really with obviously within just the industry in general. You know, we had a lot of the very high-profile mega breaches back in, you know, the mid-2000s. You know, the companies like TJX, Heartland, all these names kind of come to mind as some of the, you know, first really big breaches that started to make the news and started to go beyond just security, you know, security sites or security researchers. And so we have these mega breaches, you know, tens and millions of payment cards. And then that kind of dried up a little bit. In fact, there was one year, I can't remember what year it was, but when we started to do the calculations and we got everything together and we summed everything up, and it was like 4 million records is all we had. And we were in the room all looking at each other like, oh my goodness, what is this? And so we kind of freaked out a little bit, and we started scouring open source. We started looking for things, and there just weren't those mega breaches of payment cards happening anymore. It was completely taken over by small and medium businesses that were getting hit really, really bad. I mentioned the accommodation figure earlier when we talked about figure 29. Things like that were at a very high rate of occurrence within our data set. And so you'd see a lot more breaches, smaller companies, smaller yields. And so we kind of went from tactics like using, you know, packet sniffers and sniffing payment cards off of the wire to attacking databases and grabbing, you know, multi-millions of stored payment cards to going after the point-of-sale environment and getting them as they're being processed. So, you know, using malware that's going to capture that in process before it gets encrypted, before it gets moved on. And so we even wrote in a couple of things like, yeah, you know, we really think this is really a small business problem. We're just not seeing it with large corporations. You know, even maybe alluded to the fact that, you know, the mega breaches are kind of passe, but we couldn't have been more wrong. And that was obviously evident in, you know, Q4 of 2013. We started to see large retailers come back into the mix, and we started to see, again, multi-million dollar payment card records being lost, but not like databases, not like they did it, you know, in the mid-2000s, but again, going after that point-of-sale environment. And just like they're doing with the small businesses, they're compromising the point-of-sale environment. They're putting in malicious code that's going to take this payment card data as it's being processed and exfiltrate it out. So it's been really neat. And obviously we don't want to say neat. It's probably a bad thing to say since we're talking about criminal activity, but it's just from a research standpoint, it's very interesting to see the tactics change. And I thought it was just very interesting that a lot of this is organized criminal groups. So this isn't just lone wolves that are going after these payment cards. These are well-run organizations. And to see that they kind of laid low for a little bit and then, wham, they just started to pull off these major heists again was really something to see. And, you know, we have a section, the point of sale intrusion section has a little visual that kind of shows how it went from a database problem into the point-of-sale environment in small business. And it used to be that small businesses were majority of the records lost. And, again, now it's back to the large organizations that represent the majority of payment card records lost.
That's what was really interesting, watching how those types of the attackers themselves sort of evolve the attacks and cycle around different attack vectors. Any mm-hmm. predictions for what you'll see next year in that section? Or do you have any thoughts on that?
Sure. I mean, obviously, in order to get malware onto a system, you have to compromise. And so they're doing that a couple of different ways. With the small businesses, it still seems to be that they're just going right after the point-of-sale systems that are hanging off the Internet, typically with weak passwords. What we've seen is the ability for the adversaries to obviously to evolve and to change. And we've seen a lot of cases to where now the point-of-sale environments aren't the first environment that's actually compromised. So they're coming in another way and making their way into the point-of-sale environment. We've seen them actually go after point-of-sale vendors to actually get malware onto their systems and steal and harvest credentials to their customers and reuse them. We've even seen social tactics being used in order to try to gain credentials to gain access to point-of-sale environments. So I don't expect to see a significant amount of change, but what always seems to be at the core of this is those credentials, the credentials to the point-of-sale environment. And what I'd like to see from a security practitioner is to see, you know, two-factor authentication for access into that environment, either from the internet, or from your third-party vendor, or even from, you know, the internal network. It needs to be in a separate security zone so that just a compromised user device isn't an easy foothold to get into that area. So what I'm hoping to see is a little bit more ingenuity having to be used by these organized criminal groups, because we've done the right things on our end to force them to raise their game a little bit.
So the second item that I wanted to talk to you about from the report that may have been kind of overlooked, it kind of has a similar theme to it with stolen credentials, and that's the kinds of trends you guys saw in web application attacks. What did your data show here, and kind of what misconceptions or myths does it dispel about, you know, the types of web app attacks that are happening out there?
Yeah, when you take a look, web app attacks is one of the nine incident classification patterns. And when, you know, you talk to someone in security and you talk to them about a web application attack, they're immediately going to go to something that's going to be, you know, kind of, you know, hacking the code of the application, you know, the typical kind of pen testing mentality of breaking into it by finding, you know, validation errors where you can put in code and you can manipulate the application or the underlying database to do certain things to your favor. But in a lot of these, it is just quite simply use of stolen credentials. And really what we have here is we have companies that have applications that are essentially relying on the security of their customer base, which, you know, you or me or you know, our maybe our non-techie friends or relatives and people like that, that maybe will click on anything or go to any link and don't update antivirus and have, you know, malware all over their system, that malware that is designed to actually steal banking credentials. I mean, Zeus is a Citadel, Zbot, all these related malware, they have a keylogger component to it or functionality that's specifically trying to steal banking credentials, and it really doesn't matter how long your password is. If you got a piece of malware like that, it really nullifies any of the complexity. And we see this, I think it's in over half of them, I believe, of the web application attacks are from use of stolen credentials. So it still can be SQL injection and some of the other very common web app attacks, but a lot of times it just boils right down to reusing credentials. And we see that, we see credentials in a lot of these incident patterns. It really is something that the adversaries, regardless of their motive, are after.
That's really interesting because you're right, a lot of the focus tends to be on vulnerabilities and, you know, the same old kind of attacks that we've known and loved for a long time, but it does end up boiling down to users' credentials. I think that's really interesting because it gets the attackers further faster, obviously, too. So very interesting. So another topic, and this was the one that I kind of grabbed from the report that I thought was the most interesting. It turns out it's a little bit controversial, too. And that is that you guys came up with sort of a pretty definitive, some pretty definitive data showing that mobile devices are still not really a big factor in real-world breaches, despite all the threats we see coming out to mobile, all the malware being developed, you know, all the different, malware families we see coming out. I know you went to Verizon Wireless to get some data as well, and I think you came up with like as a 0.68% infection rate out of tens of millions of smartphones or devices, which is really low. And a lot of it was like adware and annoyanceware, I think is what you called it. Mm-hmm. And then I remember Dumbala coming out with a study like a few weeks later saying something to the effect that I think was that basically users are 1.3 times more likely to get struck by lightning than to be infected with mobile malware, which I thought was interesting. So, and I'd like to kind of get your take on this. And then there's another vendor out there, Zimperium, who's, I guess, the past couple of weeks who's been saying that they're seeing mobile attacks regularly and they're kind of disputing your findings. So I want to talk about that secondly, but first kind of from your take on what you guys found would be great to start with.
Sure. I mean, let's even step back a couple of years. I've been consistently asked, you know, what about mobile? What are you seeing in mobile? And, you know, all we can do is take a look at our data. The data is the data. And we just weren't seeing tablets and mobile phones as assets in kind of remote attack scenarios. Now, obviously, we have a lot of, you know, lost smart devices and lost tablets, lost phones, et cetera, stolen. But from a remote attack standpoint, we just weren't seeing it. We were still seeing the more typical devices, you know, workstations, laptops, as the target of crimeware or malware. And so we always just kind of said that. And so what we were able to do is try to get a little bit of, or not a little bit, but a good amount of data from Verizon Wireless that kind of supports the lack of those assets in our data set. And while the threat rate is extremely low right now when it comes to malware, you know, we're not saying that, you know, we're to ignore this. We're actually saying, hey, we have a really good opportunity here to actually get ahead of things. There was a publication yesterday that kind of talked about Loft and how they testified before Congress back in the late 90s saying, hey, all of this is being implemented very insecurely. This is something you really need to worry about. And you know, there just wasn't a lot of action being taken then, and now it's almost too late. Well, we don't want to repeat that same thing with the mobile space, because while it's a very low threat right now, it is only going to get higher.
That's a good point. I've had that conversation with other folks on the software security side, you know, saying we have the model of what we did wrong in the PC space with malware, so we shouldn't be repeating ourselves on the mobile side. So I think that's a really interesting argument. But in terms of like Zimperium's argument, they were saying that the stuff they were looking at are targeted attacks, and basically those are attacks that may come via spear phishing emails, the classic approach, and they may not be visible on a cell network, and a lot of these attacks are meant to evade detection, so they're harder to see, and that's the space that they focus on the actual endpoints themselves. So they felt like they're seeing stuff happening out there, so they're arguing that it really is happening, it's just not as visible, you know, in terms of the cell network and that kind of thing. I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on that.
Yeah. And we're looking at two different things here. You know, are the information that we received was malware, you know, malware instances on mobile devices. You know, again, I can't speak to their data because I don't have my hands on it. And that would be certainly something I would be interested in. If there is good data that is showing this to be more significant than what we're seeing on our end, we do this very transparently. And, you know, again, kind of the data is the data. You know, not only are we not seeing it in, you know, malware on these mobile devices, but we really are not seeing this in our corpus. We're just not seeing these being utilized. And, you know, it's one of those things where I think that it would be very interesting from a research standpoint. If they're talking about spear phishing, if they are writing this code with the knowledge that someone's going to be opening it up in, you know, via smartphone as opposed to, you know, just a regular, you know, Outlook or whatever mail client they're running on their normal system. So it'd be very interesting, you know, if these are extremely, extremely targeted attacks, if they know that they're utilizing certain technologies and that's how they script the spear phishing. But again, that'd be something that hopefully we can find more information on. And if there is some stuff out there that we can utilize and put into our report, we'd be more than happy to do it. But again, we really just aren't seeing it. And the thing about getting hit by lightning is kind of funny. It is something that is going to increase. Hopefully, we'll start to do some better things and better jobs defending the traditional assets that are in our data set and kind of force people to evolve and force people to actually move into other vectors. That's kind of what we're always trying to do here, is to make things harder and to disrupt the easy patterns that the assailants are using day in and day out.
So another part of the report that you and I chatted about a little bit was the whole human factor piece of the puzzle. And I know we talk a lot about that in the industry, you know, social engineering, user credentials, but I kind of wanted to see if you could drill down a little bit on what you thought in that section maybe didn't get the attention that it probably should have had gotten.
Sure. I think that, first off, it's really easy to just kind of make that a really gloom and doom type of section where you talk about just how well this tactic is working for adversaries. And, you know, when we talk about phishing, we have an entire section on that this time. And so instead of touching on it in other areas, like, you know, we talked about it a lot in cyber espionage. In years past, over 90% of all cyber espionage incidents began with targeted phishing attacks. It's a little less now. It's around 66% in our data set. Some of that has been taken over by things like strategic web compromises. There are other ways to try to get their foothold. But it's extremely significant. And, you know, we talk about how, you know, 23% of users click on, you know, will open up a mail, and 11% will actually interact with it. And it's the 11% that interact with it that are the ones that are going to be the vectors. So that's how the malicious code is going to get installed. So I don't think that we're ever going to be able to, quote, fix people, right? You know, they always say you can't patch a human. certainly security awareness training goes a long way, and that will help lower those rates, but it's never going to be. And a lot of these have a lot of work that's been put into them, right? A lot of research and some source intelligence gathering associated with these attacks. So it's very easy to be able to do this. So we need to kind of put our focus on a couple of different areas, right? Let's not harp on the 11% so much. But let's also rejoice in the 89% that don't take the bait. And let's put some things in place that would allow them to be able to act as a kind of a human sensor network that's used quite a bit. And that's all well and good, but you have to have an established process and procedure to where that if someone does identify something as being, fishy, I guess pun intended, that they know exactly what they should do with that. They know who they should contact. And it would be nice if you could even build in some automation to say, hey, just click this if you see something like this, and it'll go to the right people. And then you have to also have a secondary process in place to be able to respond to that, to be able to say, okay, there's a phishing campaign. This is the payload that it has. Be able to quickly identify who opened and who clicked, and then be able to identify what's going on with the systems, to be able to see if there's any beaking out, to be able to see if there's been any data exfiltration. And one of the things I kind of talk about is we also have to do a better job of making it harder for an adversary that compromises a user device, be a phishing or be a drive-by or what have you, make it harder for them to get to their ultimate goal from that. Make a compromised PC on your internal LAN not as valuable, because you have things like network segmentation, security zones, and multi-factor authentication between zones, and all of these good things that will really limit the impact of a successful phishing attack. And of course, phishing is not the only way that we also use the human as a vector. There's still a lot of pretexting. So pretexting is our terminology for the kind of typical social engineering, calling up the story, some sort of pretext that you are someone you need someone to do something, either provide information or visit some site, or alter and influence human behavior in some form or fashion. And that is something that is continuing to be done. And again, security awareness training is obviously one thing, but lessening the damage if someone takes the bait of some form or fashion and their computer is compromised, trying to make it harder for the ultimate goal, especially with things like cyber espionage, where they're looking for trade secrets and intellectual property. Obviously, if it doesn't need to be resident on that device, the initial device compromised, obviously it shouldn't be there, but make it a lot harder. Make them work harder to get what they want.
There's just so much in this report. I'm sure it's inspiring people to go back and read through it again. I know I want to. There's a lot of elements here. It covers a lot of ground. It's really neat to have all these different sources that you guys have now too. So we're getting close to the end of our live part of the program, but I want one more question for you before we go over to the chat. And that is, can you give us a sneak peek of what we might see in next year's report in terms of like either format or kinds of stuff you're going to be covering, maybe you didn't cover this year? I know you can't tell us the actual breaches that have happened, some that are going to happen, but any little tidbits you can give us on that?
Well, I can't make any promises, but here's what I'd like to see. I certainly would like to see us continue some of the research topics that we did. We dipped our toe in the water this year. So we talked about the contributors that did not provide incident data. The before and beyond the breach section was something that was completely new. Mm-hmm. And we did that for two reasons. One, because we thought it was really interesting, right? And we thought it was cool. Number two, when we took a look at all of the incidents from last year's data set and you kind of compare it to the year before, there wasn't a lot of huge spikes, trends, aha moments, as we call it in the report. So we really wanted to put some focus on something that'd be new and get people thinking. And so that's why we did all these before and beyond the breach sections, like phishing, the impact data, the the malware data, which I thought was fascinating. I'd like to try to improve upon all of those. I think that we will continue to try to also find maybe a couple other research areas. I don't know what that is right now, and a lot of it might have to do with us just building another partnership and getting a new data set in that we're able to get our hands dirty with and be able to put something out. But certainly, we always will continue to analyze incidents, aggregate them, and put them out. But we are always looking to do some other research things that would help be supplementary to that, or we could really tie into what's going on in the real world.
Well, that sounds great. As always, we'll look forward to the publication of the report, because it's always the big moment in the industry, as you can tell on Twitter the minute it comes out. And we also enjoy reading the jokes. And I do have one final question for you live. I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you write a lot of the jokes?
Do I write a lot? You know, honestly, I don't write as many as what people might think, because I just had someone email me and they said, oh, that Mark guy must be a big movie buff and music guy. And I am on both counts, absolutely. But my writing style a lot of times tends to be a little more kind of academic. And I'll try to throw a zinger in here or there, but honestly, if it doesn't come out organically, I don't want to just put it in there in order for us to be able to get acquired quirkiness per page that is necessary to get people to read a 70-page report. And the reason that we do that is because, you know, at the heart of it, we really treat the data with a lot of respect, and we don't do anything with the data to help us, you know, serve us in any way. We don't try to play around with it or anything like that. The data is the data, so we don't get creative with the data in the analysis. But we'd like to be creative a little bit when we start to describe some things, and I think it makes it a lot more readable for the average user.
Absolutely. That's what makes it, I think, even more fun, is looking for the little tidbits of jokes and lighthearted moments, too. So I think everybody appreciates that.
Mm-hmm. And I'll try to leave on that. We've done a lot of Coen Brothers references, a lot of Princess Bride. So I think we'll probably retire Princess Bride for sure, but I don't know. We'll see what I can do. Maybe I can try to get some Wes Anderson quotes. That'd be a lot more difficult and maybe a lot harder for people to realize that that's what we're doing. So I think I might try to do a little less is more and make some of the connections harder to get.
Sounds good. Well, Mark, I really appreciate your taking time to talk to us today. It was really interesting. And I'm going to hand it back to Kurt as Mark and I head towards the chat. Thank you so much. And thanks for joining us today on Dark Reading Radio. And here's Kurt back at you. So it looks like we might have lost Kurt. So we're going to go ahead and head over to the chat. So please join us there. Mark's going to join us. If you have any questions for him, he can take them, and we see some already queuing up there. So thank you for taking time to join us today. And thanks, Mark.
Thank you.